podcast, Greater Than Yourself, Season 5. Thank you for listening. Do you have a question about sobriety, the 12 steps, sponsorship, or just want to contact someone from the podcast? Email us at podcastgreaterthanyourself@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at dr_silkworth or a podcast greater than yourself. If you're enjoying the podcast, please give us a rating on your podcast app and share the show with anyone who may benefit.
I don't need to be recording anything, right? You're doing that on your end.
No, I got it, man.
Great. Okay, cool.
Tony, make the car go boom.
Wow. Right to that.
I'm stuck at 1989. I can't not think of Tony when I...
And no, we are not talking about Taylor's version of that album that you just said, where that song does not appear, I don't think. Could be a vault track.
Is Taylor doing versions of other albums, other people's albums now? That's the
no, but
move.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Just genre is Taylor's version, right? And with a reasonable revenue split, I can't imagine a lot of people saying no.
Right. Firstly, it's just the albums. Secondarily, it's going to be a genre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in 40 years, it's a religion.
Yeah. It certainly will be a religion in 40 years. That's okay. For sure. Yeah.
So it's currently a religion.
I went to one of those Eras tour shows, and mega church vibe would not be, too far off.
I forgot.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Look what I've got.
Nice. Ooh, black cherry. That's a good one. I got cherry limeade. So, I'm a little cheerier, a little limier.
Yeah, I know, you limey bastard. I know that the town where I went to high school, my high school was named after Churchill, and there's like there's a bunch of streets and apartment buildings in the area and civic centers and things like that with English names.
Wonderful.
And I remember
my
grandparents came to visit once, and we were driving around, and we got to the fourth thing, and it was just quiet in the car. And then my grandpa goes, "What's with all the limey shit?" racist against British people somehow.
I think that's I'm not gonna say it's defensible, but it's understandable. I would have thought that one of the main privileges of living in a rebellious colony, it should be that I don't have to hear about race scientists like Winston Churchill anymore. But what are you gonna do?
I don't have to hear about the stinking Brits.
Exactly.
Half of my TikTok feed currently, and I say currently because I'm the type of neurodivergent where I get hyper fixated on some dumb thing, and it changes, every 6 days. But right now,
absolutely,
it's very, very weird British TikTok again. It's cycled around. So currently, there's this one dude who eats, and it's two camera, obviously, and this is a good summation of every video. It's big up the chip shop, big up the chips, big up curry sauce, to the mashes. But he takes a fork and he impales 15 of the driest, most flavorless looking steak fries you've ever seen, shoves them in his mouth, and then it's chomp, chomp. It's two, maybe three bites, and then goes this dry swallow.
Ew.
And it's just I'm watching this man force a whole fried potato down his gullet.
I hate liquid.
It is so upsetting, and like apparently I've told TikTok through my viewing time and clicks and stuff that I want to see only that right now.
Yes, right, because the algorithm cannot discern fascinated delight and fascinated horror. All that matters is that you're fascinated.
What are you doing with your eyes? What are you watching?
Right, exactly. As long as you can't look away, it doesn't matter what the subjective experience for you is like. That sounds genuinely awful.
It's bad. To me, still preferable to some friends in recovery who, like, their TikTok algorithm must just be nonstop, like, psychopath recovery stuff. It's just like they're always sending me crazy recovery stuff.
Yeah, I can't take very much of that stuff. I was blissfully unaware of it until I saw somebody else pass along some video in the genre of essentially, you know, I'm selling something that's not AA, and here's why the thing you've heard of, AA, is bad, right?
Right.
And I was like, wow, I hate this so much that I need to be careful, because I don't want to start getting this kind of content. And if I stare at it and see the way that I want to, I know that I will.
Yes.
And I don't get that. I mostly get, you know, plants growing, like the time-lapse videos of plants growing. I like that a lot.
It's wholesome.
Peaceful stuff. You know, I try not to feed the beast too much. I've had to go in and reset my algorithm a couple of times when it started to get me into some weird areas, but not too bad. Plants growing is nice.
Nice. Well, what we're going to do today is a new type of episode. I'm freewheeling here, brother. I'm freewheeling.
I like it.
I'm calling this One Alcoholic Talks with Another Alcoholic.
Okay. So that's OATWAA.
Yes. The Initialism Great. Whisperer is what we call him.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Did you impress how I knew the first letter of all those words? It
was remarkable. Clearly high GPA. I don't even know how to say it. GPA. Okay. Yeah. So basically I've got some stuff I want you to rank. That's kind of what we're doing. Okay. We're kind of talking.
All right,
about,
good.
Let's play favorites. Cause everyone,
let's do it. I love that.
A lot of people in recovery try to act like you get into recovery and then like you're no longer able to use your own personality to discern things you like and do not like. And
yeah, exactly. You've got to kind of have the standard mush that you sort of get, you know, that's just an average of everyone you've ever been to an AA meeting with. Otherwise you're not staying in the center of the boat, I think is what that means.
Yeah, it's like, well, if I tell my wife that I really don't care for oatmeal, then would that really be loving and tolerant? You're just going to eat shitty oatmeal every morning for the rest of your life?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Because the two choices that you can be is you can be a hate-filled, resentful asshole, or you can be a complete doormat who won't give anybody any information about anything that they like or don't like. So choose wisely.
Which, the latter of which, not selfish at all.
No. People like it. People like knowing that they cannot ever trust what you say about anything that they do. They love it. Makes them feel good and secure.
People pleasing is very honest and very selfless.
It pleases them. It's right in the name.
You can't miss. Okay. First thing we're going to do is overrated or underrated.
Okay.
All right. Recovery memes.
Underrated. Because I think that there's something about memes that, because they can't have too much writing and thinking, can convey like the feel of something in a way that's like more than like better than conveying the think of something. And for a lot of people, and I'm definitely one of them, who are prone to trying to think themselves out of alcoholism, mm-hmm. there is something penetrating about also humor, right? I mean, there's some bad recovery memes, but I got a lot out of them, you know, especially in the early phases of recovery, where I was really trying to, as much as anything, learn and practice a certain kind of like attitude and approach. So I think that they're, you know, I think that they're good. I think that they're, you know, obviously, and it's hard to like, for some reason, it seems harder to make a bad one. You know, I mean, obviously, because like a bad meme is just not going to become memetic, right? If it's not good, it's not going to get shared. The only way is to sort of, I don't know. Is that anything?
Harder to make a bad one. I don't know. Have you seen Fucking Sober's Instagram page?
Lately, you know,
I'm kidding.
So I don't know. But I think that, certainly I don't think that they're as widely appreciated because they're also a bit age gated, right? Like somebody, you know, the people who, you know, appreciate them are still pretty young. So overall, I think that there are, you know, for probably some suffering 55-year-olds who, you know, a good meme could be just what sets the ball rolling.
Right. Nice. All right. Overrated or underrated? Step studies.
Way overrated. way overrated. And I know of what I speak because I used to, years ago, I went to those all the time. Mm-hmm. And they seem so seductive and appealing. Because, you know, my initial contact with people in AA and in rehab was basically like, look, you want to work these steps to get better, right? Good message, right? Like on the ball. And, you know, you're going off back to where you live, but try to do that. So I see step study and the little list. I'm like, hey, that's what they said. These guys said to do. The problem is like, I show up, right? If it's, and I'm, you know, completely unrecovered. If it's not about step one, then, you know, what am I supposed to do with this information, right? I'm sitting there as a completely untreated person, and I'm hearing a lot of good thoughts about, like, step nine. I'm not ready to do that. I don't have a list of people I've harmed. I don't have any idea the things that are keeping me blocked from a, you know, two-way relationship with my maker. You know, I don't even know if I'm an alcoholic yet. But then once I'm in the chute, right, once I've, you know, had my first step kind of experience and understanding, what am I doing going to a bunch of meetings about the steps instead of doing them? Mm-hmm. Right? Like if I were genuinely unclear on how to do like a fourth step, and there happened to be a fourth step study meeting like that day, then I guess that could maybe help, although, you know, even then I'm a little bit dubious. But like ideally I would have some person I could call, right, who was working with me, who could kind of talk me through that, mm-hmm. right? So they just don't, I would go to them, and the other problem is it would feel like I was, quote, working the steps. Like right. Going to the step study meeting, I've got these notes now in my book, and I feel like I've got a better understanding of certain stuff, and I may have had a better understanding. But I'd leave and I'd have taken no additional action, and then I'd be kind of tired. I kind of feel like I've done for the day. Yeah, you know what I mean? Time to go home and, you know, just
went to my AA curl class.
Exactly. I went to my AA class. Exactly. Now it's time to come home, play video games, right, and enter the curious mental blank spot again, you know? Yeah. So I just, they don't do a lot for me. I could sort of see them being effective among, you know, if you had such studies among people who had already recovered and were kind of trying to talk about the best way to like teach them to new people, that could be kind of a cool idea. I've never seen anything like that.
Mm, right. All right. Okay. What about sober celebrities?
Underrated or overrated by whom? Right. Because I feel like in the general population, sober celebrities tend to be pretty highly rated. Mm-hmm. And they tend, you know, there tend to be a lot of kind of interest and accolades piled upon this because, I mean, you know, it's interesting and sometimes they have sort of, you know, amusing stories or whatever. But I feel like among people I know in the fellowship of AA and who themselves have recovered from alcoholism, they tend to have quite a low regard, especially because in most, not all cases, you got people who are, for one thing, breaking anonymity, which is like, you know, a lot of people have a low opinion of that. And I don't, you know, I'm in that group. In many cases, the message that they are promoting is, you know, odd or distorted in certain ways, you know, like, you know, RFK Jr. talks about having been to like 10,000 meetings in his life. And he's, I mean, you know, bless his heart. I'm glad it's working for him.
The Will Chamberlain, you know, here, of AA meetings.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. In many ways, in so many ways, in so many ways. And I just, you know, so I feel like that's not, you know, it actually has helped me understand why the prohibition on why we're supposed to stay anonymous at this level. Because, you know, when I was really new, I got exposed to some kind of confusing and conflicting messages as a result of, you know, just there's a lot of sort of information coming into your ear. So, you know, I mean, now that said, there's a special kind of sober celebrity that I feel like is almost by definition underrated. And that's the one that you either don't know is sober, or like you can find it out because they may have mentioned it one time in an interview or something, but they really don't make it a focus of, you know, their work, and they don't break anonymity. I'm thinking here about people like Anthony Hopkins, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and say Anthony Hopkins is overrated, but it's precisely because they just present this example of, if they present an example of sobriety at all, it's an example by like deeds and talking about it a lot. You know, I'm into that. That's cool. So a little both on that one.
So just a quick little aside. Do you think RFK Jr. is so jacked because he's been doing push-ups in the parking lot with his disease?
Well, he seems to have the phenomenon of craving when it comes to certain anabolic steroids. You know what I mean?
You're gonna get me sued.
I guess that's just his alcoholism. You know what I'm saying? That's all it is.
All right, overrated or underrated? Going through the big book line by line.
Think it's a little overrated. I think it is a little bit overrated because I really do understand, and I should say by way of background, that is not how I was taken through the work. And the reason that I wasn't, and the guy that worked with me was very much a carrier of the undiluted message in the big book. We worked out of the big book, but he had sort of isolated the operative instructions and sort of tried to convey them to me in a way that allowed me to work quickly. Because one of the things that attracted me to this guy was he seems to kind of get the problem that I was dealing with, which is that my ability to stay sober for even a few days had kind of withered by the end. And so every time I would commence to work through the big book with a new sponsor, and we'd sort of start at the preface to the fourth edition or whatever, and kind of take this line by line approach, I would just, my timer would kind of go off before we could get me to a source of real spiritual power.
Right.
And so, although I suppose it's in theory possible, so as a result of that, I really have always thought of, you know, like pace and speed as really important, you know, factors in a person's recovery, because for one thing, you know, the book Alcoholics Anonymous itself, I think, suggests explicitly at certain points, implicitly at other points, a certain pace. And that pace may not be compatible with a line by line close study of the book.
Right.
Which is not to say that I haven't read at this point every line in that first 164 pages more than once. I have, which is kind of the second thing that I sort of feel is the best time to learn something is probably not when I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, right? I'm not going to be great at retaining the information. You know, the study that I made of the big book was really more something that I was able to do in recovery. once my mind had sort of become all of a sudden like able to like absorb new information again, right. once I could concentrate on things again, once I could actually understand, like once I was seeing this stuff work in my life, the text became much easier to sort of understand and less abstract. So that's kind of my basic view. Now, that said, I would still prefer, a lot of people have recovered by sort of going through the book line by line, and when you encounter an instruction, you do it. Mm-hmm. And if that approach is less daunting to somebody who, for example, may be sponsoring for the first time, and is like, I don't know how to do this, mm-hmm. sort of just, you know, riff it. The guy who worked with me, he'd been recovered for 20 years, right? He sponsored hundreds of people. And so he was like, you know, he quite practiced at this. It was easy for him. But I remember when I started out, I was like, definitely had a feeling of like, I don't know quite what to do here. And if I, you know, taking a person line by line through the book, if it gets a person working with others, it certainly beats, you know, call me every day, you know, let's go to a lot of meetings, right. you know, stuff like not solution type stuff. I just hopefully it's something that at least in an appropriate case, I think even the most line by liney person would hopefully be willing to deviate for if they were working with somebody who was just they could not stay sober through the conversation about, you know, more about alcoholism or whatever. They would just drink every time. I would hope that at that point we could understand that, you know, maybe here what we need to do is kind of pick this up a little bit, right. and we'll get to some of the details down the road.
Yeah. All right. Overrated or underrated? Grand sponsors.
The appropriate rating for that is zero. a truly deranged concept, in my humble opinion, that can only lead to mischief. Because look, in the real, you know, in normal life, tendency, at least I've noticed this tendency of grandparents to interfere in the raising of their grandchildren is, you know, harmless to sometimes even mildly beneficial, right? But what I've noticed it tends to sort of start to turn into in like AA is that is just a short step away from a truly Lovecraftian horror, the sponsorship line, right? Which is demonic and must, I mean,
it's at least that's, Philip K. Dick.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, big time. It's Thomas Pynchon, folks, because that's an inherent vice if I've ever seen one, folks. Talk about the book. Because I don't think what that suggests is, first of all, it suggests a kind of permanency to the relationship that is not warranted. You know, you may end up being friends with the person who works with you for a long time. Mm-hmm. You might not.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's nice when that happens. But the idea of then hierarchizing it, if that is a word, such that like the guy that worked with me has a kind of like relationship with the people that I work with in some way that needs to be recognized socially is like this is weird, and it really does kind of set up like a patriarch at the head. And it's how you get stuff like, you know, the Pacific group and all these things that are just these huge temptations to indulge in ego, right. to indulge in all the stuff that will kill me, you know? I don't like it. It's weird. It's very weird when somebody knows a little too much about their sponsor line, you know, I'm like, that's like, who cares, right?
I mean, we don't kink shame on this podcast, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, like Bill W's sponsor, Ebby, he died of alcoholism, right? He couldn't stay sober. I always thought it was quite tender that Bill continued to refer to him as his sponsor, you know, even as his life progressed and he just couldn't stay sober. What that indicates, though, is that there's no like, you know, this isn't a rank system, right? Like, there's no superior officers. There's no like, it doesn't work like that. All of us are kind of gears. And we're all just trying to, you know, that's why the, you know, the analogy of shipwrecked passengers really seems to fly in the face of the idea that once we get to the deserted island, we're going to reconstruct the captain's table. We're going to build an area for steerage and everyone's going to get back into the sort of ranks that they were in before. That I just don't, that's just not appropriate. And that's what the grand sponsor thing starts to remind me of too much.
Right. I like that you mentioned grandparents, because I do feel like that sort of lineage thing and the ranking system thing, I think that it's all part of the rampant infantilization of the newcomer.
Yes.
Which is profoundly disturbing and I feel like harmful, you know? It's just like you come to AA, you're a grown up, and then like we're gonna tell you you don't know what's best for you. You don't know who you are. You got to do this. You got to do that. We're going to run your fucking life. And it's just like, I don't know.
Right.
It doesn't seem like the book is saying any of that, you know?
It right. It really doesn't. It really, really doesn't. And in fact, even though at points, right, this idea of grand sponsorship and lineage, like, for example, the sort of line of social contact that runs from Carl Jung to like Roland, then to Ebby, then to Bill, the sort of like one after another connections of those people are not spelled out in the book. Mm-hmm. Because you know, even though if this were an important idea to sort of trace this back to like a fountainhead, could have easily done that. Right. But none of that is mentioned. Instead, what's mentioned is like this person was like my friend from school. He came to my house and he was just like me, and I could see he was sober and so on and so on. The idea that he was like two steps away from this great psychiatrist or whatever is not introduced, even though by the point of time he's writing the book, of course, Bill knew that.
Right.
And yeah, like I chafed quite a bit at the beginning from that sense of being treated like I was a baby, right? Which I was not. I was certainly in many respects in need of some, I had some growing up to do, certainly, but I was still a grown up, right? Yeah. And I was still the people who, I'll put it this way. If the objective of any of us is to help other people, then we should be aware that infantilizing them may not be very helpful to them at all. Mm. And so we shouldn't do it for that reason.
Yep. All right. Overrated or underrated? Serenity.
Yeah, you know, I almost don't really know what it is. To tell you the truth, you know, I realize that it's the thing that I'm supposed to be able to match calamity with, right? I know that part, and I know it's in the prayer, you know, the classic prayer we all know and love.
I'm not sure I've heard of that.
it's on a coin, you know. I misplaced mine, I think that it's like because it kind of look as a general thing. That's like saying, you know, human warmth. Now, that's good. It's a good thing. Serenity, you know, that's a positive concept. But it plays no operational part in getting better from alcoholism, right? There's the concept of serenity, you know, as I say, it's mentioned in sort of passing. But like, if what we're here to do is to help people recover from alcoholism, then there are certain ideas like powerlessness that we need to introduce and at least be somewhat clear on in order to understand the nature of our predicament and so on, right? Or the, you know, the like anger, we need to understand some things about that. Serenity feels to me more like a thing that like should simply, it'll come out as a byproduct if you're doing certain stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you don't need to be thinking about doing it too much, right? I feel the same way about sort of like all sorts of, you know, slogany virtues like acceptance, you know,
right.
And like, you know, yeah, they're all good things, but they should, but they can only emerge from me if I'm taking the actions necessary to be free of the prison of self. They're like descriptions of how I will feel as I grow spiritually. Mm-hmm. They're not descriptions of anything I can do.
Right.
And they're not descriptions of a state I can think myself into. Of that, I'm completely sure. Right.
Right.
So, you know, it's like the concept of height. You know, a kid is not going to get any taller or shorter by knowing a lot or thinking a lot about height.
Right.
Instead, what's important is that they be, you know, well nourished, et cetera, et cetera. And then the height will just sort of emerge. And I feel that way about serenity. There's like, you know, sometimes you'll see it as like a topic at a meeting. I'm like, I don't know what to say. Right. What to say? The topic is, you know, I'm just at peace with, I'm so at peace. I have nothing to say about it. You know, there's nothing to do.
Right. All right. Overrated or underrated steps 6 and 7.
You know, it's tempting to say overrated because there's that book that's supposed to be about them that I've never read.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what the problem there is.
Is that the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or is it the?
It's the one about the magician's nephew.
Okay, yeah,
he discovers his character defects.
I was literally trying to think of any other Narnia book. I'm like,
me too. I was like, Voyage of Prince Caspian.
The
I think that's too.
No, that's Alice in Chains.
Yeah. I think, though, what happens with 6 and 7 is not that they are overrated. It is that they are overcomplicated,
mm-hmm.
right? They are, in fact, quite simple, but I think quite essential, mm-hmm. and probably in operation of, like, certainly my life, and I think there's a real temptation to this for anybody, underrated in their importance in, like, the following way, which is one of the most important ideas to me that comes out of the discussion of the third step is the idea, not only, of course, that self and self-centeredness are the root of my troubles. That's a very important idea. But right after that is an idea that is almost as important, which is that there often seems to be no way of getting rid of this selfishness on my own power,
mm-hmm.
right? There are even readings, you know, of those first, you know, 40 pages or whatever, where it kind of almost sounds like my inability to reduce my selfishness on my own power is kind of the powerlessness that I'm experiencing, mm-hmm. in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very important idea, that just because it's, you know, as I think back on my life, I knew I was being very selfish in a lot of ways.
Right.
Now, there were more ways I didn't clearly reflect on, but it was pretty obvious to me that I was being unbelievably and unbearably self-centered. And oftentimes I could even understand that this was not how I wanted to be living my life,
right.
that it was contributing to the misery of people around me and to me. And the problem is I just couldn't seem to get much better as a person. And it's 6 and 7, I think, that firmly separate this from being a sort of program of self-help,
mm.
and instead turn it into a real spiritual discipline where it's like, okay, I've identified and I want to cast out these things, but I've shared them with another person. And now I'm going to take these steps, which are so simple. They only require a couple of paragraphs to describe, but are absolutely operationally crucial, unless I'm going to just have to relearn that lesson again, that, like, okay, I can see now that I'm being filled with pride in all my interactions with people, and that's why I'm mad all the time. If I just think to myself, well, I guess I'll just be less prideful, I'll try my best, I'm not sure I'm going to be encouraged by the results, right? But if I have enough humility to say, you know, to take those, to, you know, that seventh step prayer is so humble,
mm.
right? It doesn't even actually specify, like, I want you to remove all my defects of character, right? It even delegates that to God. Maybe I've got some growing left to do. It even expresses no judgment about whether it would be more useful for me to, you know, not grow out of all my character defects immediately. It's an incredibly mm-hmm. humble prayer. And so for that reason, like, I think that, you know, they should neither be overcomplicated, but neither should they be, like, you know, they are really important. If this is not just to be a program of self-help, but to really find yourself growing into a state that, you know, sometimes, and I have this experience sometimes, you look around and think, I cannot believe how different I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And if you, to really have the sense that, like, this could not have been done by me and was not done by me. And I know, because I tried hard for a long time and I got no results. And then I did this and I was like astonished at how quickly it was possible for me to change. So they're overcomplicated, but probably underrated, I think.
Right. All right. The meeting after the meeting.
Is that still a thing, right? Because there's like, because a lot of, obviously a lot of activity
clearly
on Zoom,
you're
and
not
people
doing service work. Okay.
Yeah. I guess I'm not, right? Because I feel like there's the problem with this on Zoom and a little less in person, is if a person is, you know, some people have more than one problem, and some people in life are troubled by, for example, codependence, right? This seems to be a real, like, maybe test for a person who might be, like, afraid that they're going to miss stuff if they don't hang around. Mm-hmm. It also seems to, not for nothing, by the way, but people have real demands on their time. People may have, like, right, young children. People may have, you know, jobs they need to get to. And, you know, increasing the time commitment of a meeting, you know, especially when it's not clear that, you know, are we really sure that the previous 60 minutes or whatever needs to be multiplied? Like, was it so good that there needs to be more of that? I'm not sure I'm into that, right? Now, and of course, it's not meant to say that, like, you know, need a little time if you're going to approach some sick, suffering person and, you know, offer to show them the way out. But that to me implies actually that there should be no more group interaction sort of at the curtain, because right, now what should be happening, if anything is happening, is that individual people should be walking up to other individual people and, you know, swallowing the lump they may have in their throat and introducing themselves, right? Yeah. As opposed to that space being filled with more kind of group mediated interactions, which, you know, group mediated interactions can be great, but this group is not going to sponsor you, right? Probably some individual person is. We need to open up space, if anything, to let those conversations happen. So not good.
Yeah.
Not good.
Hell yeah. Okay. Overrated or underrated? Gratitude.
it feels a little bad to say that gratitude is overrated, but that is not to say it is not good. Rather, it is to understand what gratitude can and cannot do for me. For example, one thing I'm very sure of is that gratitude cannot keep me sober. It cannot give me the power to hold myself in check just because I'm grateful for a lot of the stuff in my life. So if that's what it's being drafted into service to do, then a person is, I think, as I did, going to find themselves pretty disappointed. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I was walking down the street yesterday. I was just sort of walking my dog. And that, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Coco. I'm guessing based on what I know of you. Probably yes. So there's that line in the very beginning.
Like, Mama Coco.
Yes, absolutely. I love it. My son was Miguel in the skeleton getup for Halloween one year when he was really little. Awesome. Extremely cute.
Awesome.
And there's that line in the beginning when Miguel says that of his, I guess, great 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 grandparents or whomever, that they would sing songs and, among other things, count their blessings. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of lovely. And I was walking down the street and I found myself doing that in a non-metaphorical way, but I was actually just found myself kind of tracing over in my mind the variety of things about my life for which I was really grateful. Mm-hmm. And I felt very happy doing this. And I was like, for the first time understood that line from Coco. Like, does he mean that that's actually like an activity that they would sit down and do? Because it does right. sound kind of nice now that I'm doing it like this. But it was a completely interior experience. I mean, I guess I'm talking to you about it now and ruining it, but it was just something that happened inside me. And I felt gratitude for what God had done in my life to make all of this possible. I felt happy about it. And that was it. It just kind of sat on its own bottom. I didn't write anything down because, I mean, the record of all of these things is all around me. What do I need a piece of paper to say that I have, you know, for example, like, you know, my son is healthy. He's beautiful. We have this wonderful relationship. I don't need to write that down on a piece of paper, right? He's in his bedroom. I can just go see it for myself and so on. So I think that as an experience, if it's authentic, it can be quite powerful. Trying to manufacture it, you know, I don't know about that. You know, forcing yeah. yourself to kind of, you know, when you're in a bad mood, count your blessings. A lot of people swear by it. But for me, I felt it more powerfully, kind of like we were discussing before, as an authentic byproduct yeah. of just trying to approach life with a certain attitude and then finding myself just, you know, picking up dog shit and feeling really grateful for the things about my life that were, you know, all of them, you know, just normal stuff, right? Nothing extraordinary, but really appreciating all those things rather than trying to beat myself up about the fact that maybe I don't feel that way all the time. Yeah. And now, in addition to not feeling grateful, I actually feel guilty. And how is that? It gets a little self-obsessed at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So also I feel like I ended up in a lot of these WhatsApp groups that are sort of associated with certain, you know, groups or meetings where, and they're like these huge groups, you know, 100 people or whatever in them. And I have them all on mute because I feel like inevitably you're going to get two or three people in a group that size that are just posting their daily gratitude list to the chat. Yeah. And I'm like, who is this for? What is this for? What are you bragging? Like, you know, like, I mean, it's not good. So again, you know, a good thing to have, not probably a good thing to like, you know, like try to manufacture. So
right.
overrated gratitude.
Yeah. And I think the, it kind of goes hand in hand with the concept of the 6 and 7 that you were talking about earlier. Toward the beginning of what you were just saying, there is this idea presented that like making a list of things for which I am grateful is going to somehow keep me sober. And like,
right.
not only would that not keep me sober, but like making a list of things for which I'm grateful would not even keep me grateful. Like, let alone fucking sober.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like...
100%.
Like, trying to exercise some sort of character asset won't even help me with that asset, let alone the thing that's killing me, you know?
That's a great way... That's an excellent, really good way to think about it, right? That that there is a... It trends a little too close to the, like... magic spell theories of sobriety right. where like taking a bunch of like ritualized actions will by adherence to them only and not because they're just sort of practical exercises to keep me in contact with God, who is the one who's actually relieving me of alcoholism, but rather I'm it's almost like I'm doing a spell.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work, right? I know that it does. It's the same thing as like going to the gym or eating better. These are good things to do. But to place your faith in them, it seems to me to be like a real, you know, step one or two problem where,
yeah, and it's like, I know that they don't work for me because I did them.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And as you say, they did not even keep me grateful. It's the same reason that for a while I would write more when I would do my 11th step, especially at night. You know, I'd sort of try to write answers to those questions. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that if a person finds that a helpful way of reflecting. But I wasn't doing it in the right spirit. I was kind of like turning it almost into like a gratitude list type exercise where the writing of these things in a kind of you know, like ritualized way means that I am like doing the thing that will thereby operate the magic, mm-hmm. instead of, and I found it getting in the way of, which was actually listening to the answers to those questions from like a place of quiet meditation and openness, right? Mm-hmm. I was instead just doing a lot of writing and relying on myself. And so I stopped doing that. And, I have to say it's a much quieter experience, but it's one where I can actually hear God's voice when I'm not, writing all the time.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right. Last one, overrated or underrated? The ninth step promises.
You mean the promises?
TM.
Yeah. Yeah, the promises. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard to know how to describe the way that they're treated. Being, does that overrate them or underrate them? Mm. Right? Because the way that they're presented is as being associated with the whole program.
Right.
And yet I almost feel like, in a curious way, as the promised outputs of really throwing yourself into this process of reconstruction, mm-hmm. and really trying to clean up the damage from your past, they are actually underrated as an experience that is associated with that. Because I think that's in part why people can, including me, can be like, maybe not throw themselves in to that process of reconstruction with the kind of ferocity that you would if you understood that these outputs, because if they're just promised to you as sort of the consequences of being an AA or doing AA,
right,
then you're going to look around your life and you're going to notice some of these are kind of coming true. You know, like, right. I guess I'm losing my fear of people. And, I guess I'm still waiting on that economic insecurity one. Looking forward to that one. You're going to look around and sort of see them kind of vaguely realized. And you're going to conclude, or at least I concluded, maybe this is kind of hyperbole or just a little bit of effective overstatement. Or maybe this output is what I'm supposed to be experiencing. And that doesn't mean everything's perfect. Whereas if once I really, had put some real work into the actual process of reconstruction that steps 8 and 9 talk about, and began to experience those things in a way that made it clear that these are not overstated, these are not written for effect, I actually did lose, my fear of, I found myself, it was very, very strange. I realized it was like, in the same way that I one day kind of noticed the absence of the desire to drink, and it felt weird because it just wasn't there and there was nothing in its place.
Right.
When I started to feel, fear of people and of economic insecurity and things like that, that had grown out of basically all this garbage in my past that needed to get cleaned up. When I started to feel that not be there and nothing be in its place, it was really something. It was a real, in other words, it was a real experience.
Right.
And one that I did not have to think myself into. So, So I think that they're overgeneralized and probably underrated as outputs of actually doing those things, not just hanging around and being an AA or going to a lot of meetings or even working with others, things like that. These are specific outputs that are promised if you do certain things that involve taking a lot of responsibility that may be quite scary and daunting to take. But this is the paycheck for it, and it's a real one. And I think people should know and be helped to understand that this is really on offer in a non-exaggerated way. You can really feel this way, but you must do certain hard things.
Hell yeah. All right. We're going to get into some power rankings to close this out.
Hell yes.
This is more of a streamlined thing. I'm going to be rapid fire. You're in the no spin zone, the hot seat.
I'm going to get my Shannon Sharp Hall of Fame jacket on.
There you go.
Let's do it.
All right. So, top tier caffeinated beverage.
Number one, I have to go with the beloved classic sugar-free Red Bull. I realized that's probably because my taste buds were irreparably damaged by drinking that mixed with vodka in quantities that should probably be measured in a new unit called super gallons. I do like it a lot. I like that it's sugar-free. And if I'm going to drink an energy drink, I at least want it to be sort of small and be associated with a successful F1 team. I mean, I guess coffee is number one. So, okay. Coffee one. I forgot about coffee.
Okay.
Coffee one, sugar-free Red Bull two.
Perfect. One point B. Okay. Top tier AA speaker.
Who's the Chris Hermier, right? That's the guy's name.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the right person.
That's a guy's name.
Yes. Okay. So I have not listened to a lot of AA speakers, in my life for whatever reason, probably because I just cannot stop talking for even long enough to listen to somebody, a recorded person talk. But I really have liked everything I've ever heard from that dude. Really helpful. And has, you know, like he has a passion and an enthusiasm, that is quite infectious and makes me feel not as silly for sometimes getting quite high energy about this stuff, because I'm like, well, you know, this guy's just as high energy, if not more. But yeah, like that guy.
Okay. Top tier prayer.
I think the top tier prayer has got to be the classic Our Father, which has an AA history. It's been an AA since the very beginning, and it has been, I just saw a post on Reddit the other day by a person who's bothered by it. People have been bothered by it since the very beginning. But I think it has a couple of virtues. First of all, I think it's used in different measure in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't see it as much in California, saw it a lot in Indiana. But it has a virtue of being a prayer that often people already know, right? So if they're coming in with some kind of religious background and they feel a little nervous about, you know, are these going to be weird spiritual ideas that are going to be sort of like, am I joining a cult? A simple prayer that's broadly agreeable to. Now, I mean, it is a Christian prayer. There's no getting around that. It is not a non-denominational prayer. And that is, you know, that's just true. But it also, you know, I can't remember where he writes about this, but Bill writes some essay or letter to somebody where he talks about this and the fact that people sort of objected to it. And he says something along the lines of, you know, it also might be useful if a person, you know, really finds it so bothersome to hear. It might be a sort of good, useful lesson to like kind of just have to deal with that a little bit and not make everything all about yourself. And then the content, you know, the content is very good. I think it expresses a lot of AA principles in a way that, you know, a lot of people are already familiar with. And so I like it for that reason.
Cool. Okay. Top tier meeting format.
Top tier meeting format.
Desert Island meeting format.
Yeah. Desert Island meeting format. I mean, I have to say,
you got
to
take one meeting format with you on your desert island trip.
It's going to be great for all the people who have to come with me to do the meeting format.
Yes, exactly.
To the desert island. You know, the classic group we all know and love, the Black Rhinos International Big Book Study Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's quite good.
I have.
Has a meeting format unlike, I don't think I've ever seen this anywhere else, which is the key part of it is a book study where you read beforehand and then come to discuss. I really, really like this because, and it did a lot to help me understand and learn about this, you know, very important text, especially early on. I really don't like other people to read to me. I just don't like it. And I don't particularly, therefore, like the format where, you know, you kind of go in a circle and each person sort of reads a little bit and you pass, and then maybe at a certain point you discuss. Not for me. It's not that it doesn't have its place. Some people, for example, can't read, and that's fine. I appreciate like sitting down, you come, and then you have a discussion about this stuff, because it's you know, I think it's also a really effective way to carry a message to a new person who can sort of, they're going to come in a conversation and they're going to sort of, you know, they're going to hear, hopefully, a discussion about this, you know, this subject mm-hmm. that attracts them to what they're hearing, right? Rather than, I like that a lot. I think it's really good. And I also, I think that it's nice when, one thing that I kind of miss a little bit about Indiana is that the speaker meeting was much less common there. That it was less common to have a single person talk for an extended period at the beginning. And when they did, it was for like more like 10 minutes rather than half an hour or 40 minutes. And I don't know, maybe it's just, you know, an anarchist strain or something, but I sort of prefer that mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's kind of going back to the shipwreck analogy, right? That we don't need icons to be looking up to. We don't want, you know, cults of personality to be developing. We want to be peers all in the same work together. And so, but yeah, pre-reading of literature and then come prepared to discuss is goated meeting format.
Awesome. All right. Top tier, big book chapter.
More About Alcoholism is the chapter that probably saved my life once I really, because I'd read it many times and I don't know what was happening with it in my head, but once I really hit the point where I actually had this subjective experience that is described many times in this book of being suddenly realizing, oh, I actually can't stop. Like, not it would be hard, not, but like I actually can't, like when I found myself just watching myself drink against my own will,
right,
unable to do anything about it. Then I read that chapter and all of it made so much sense. And I was like, oh, so that means that there's a solution to this.
Right.
Right. But that, like, it is of the utmost urgency that I find a solution to this, because I'm not, like, I mean, it's funny. I was going to say, I'm not crazy here. I am crazy. I really can't actually do this. Mm-hmm. So that was the one that then propelled me into the series of actions that are described thereafter. Right. And it wasn't until I could sort of see my sort of inchoate terror reduced to sort of just those clear descriptions of what I was going through that I was like, okay, you know, maybe I'm not hopeless. Maybe these guys are onto something. But it wasn't really until I'd had the experience to be able to identify. Because I'd read the chapter before, and if you told me that stuff, I might have been like, yeah, it makes sense. But I really had to have that experience before that chapter could mean anything to me.
Right. All right, top tier personal story from the book. Anywhere in the book. So I'm talking curling up in a barn, waiting to die guy, keys to the kingdom.
Yeah. Let me see here. Give me a second to think. I assume you could just cut out the boring silence later or lengthen it.
Maybe. Not a chance. I'm doubling this.
Yes, absolutely. So building off of the previous answer, I really think it's hard to pick a favorite, you know, maybe a consensus, you know, triple number one for the story of, you know, Whiskey Milk Jim, the story of, you know, unnamed carpet slippers guy who may or may not have actually existed. And then Fred, the guy everybody likes. Those stories illustrate in such a helpful way the different ways that a person can experience this curious mental blank spot, this lack of ability to stay stopped.
Right.
Like the guy with the carpet slippers, he's a guy who has the ability to stay stopped earlier in his life. And then he starts again, finds himself as bad off as ever, resolves to stop again and discovers that he can't, right? Which illustrates that this is something that some of us lose over time. Yeah. That, you know, early on you may be able to, but once you get past a point, you won't. You know, and then, you know, Jim and Fred so helpfully illustrate the internal mental, the interior mental state of what it feels like. And I could just so identify mm-hmm. with both of those. And Fred in particular is haunting because of the way it's just like, you know, you might think you could think yourself around the whiskey milk problem. Like, you know, I'll do a memento style, get a bunch of tattoos that are like never with milk, never with this, never with that. And you might think you could avoid the carpet slippers problem by just never starting again, never having that mistake, right? But how are you going to avoid the problem of it not entering your mind that you're an alcoholic and starting to drink as casually as if it were ginger ale, right? How are you going to avoid that one?
Right.
It's impossible. So I think those stories for me are the most powerful. I refer to them the most when I'm trying to, like, in discussions with like a new person. It can be very helpful to be like, oh, you're so, you know, you're Jim, right? Et cetera. And I think that's a really helpful teaching technique. And it makes them also feel like, you know, you're not a fuck up because you can't stay sober. Mm-hmm. Like, you're Fred, right? Yeah. And he, you know, that's not, it doesn't mean you're disqualified. It means you are, that means you are qualified.
Right. I love that you mentioned memento because, like, I'm a tattoo person. And there was a time when I legitimately was close to getting that, a tattoo of that same tenor. Like, it's just mm-hmm. going to say no. It's going to be right here on, like, the web of my hand, and I mm-hmm. will know what it means.
Absolutely.
What a fucking insane idea. But it's like, that makes more sense than going back to AA.
Yeah. I had the idea to get a tattoo of the, like, AA circle with the triangle in it, even though I had not been to AA meetings in, like, forever, was not working with anybody, was not actively taking any steps. But I thought, you know, if I'll get the picture of it on my wrist, and I'll get a cross on the other wrist, and then booyah, right? I'm glad. I can't say I'm really glad I didn't do that, because it would be, it would look fine. And now it would be, I guess, something, although it would be kind of a little cringe, right? You see, with the AA circles, it's yeah. just like, okay, wow. Yeah. Nice, you know, nice anonymity, Dillweed. So yeah.
All right, let's bring it home with the bottom tier.
Okay.
Bottom tier caffeinated beverage.
So there's this new energy drink called C4. There's a new energy.
Oh my god!
It's called C4, and I heard somebody. Yeah, I heard somebody say that, like, they drink it and don't drink it, basically. I was like, basically, I was a little bit curious about, like, well, I mean, how bad, what does it do? How bad could it be?
Right.
And so I bought one in the gas station.
I'm going for it. Okay, yeah.
I'm going for it. And you see, that is simply my alcoholism.
Oh,
right?
Yes, of course.
Absolutely had an incredibly unpleasant experience. It made my face feel hot and sort of tingly. And I don't know what's doing that. It's not caffeine, because I drink coffee all the time. You know, yeah. I drink my all this stuff. Whatever is in that should not be legal for sale in the United States.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully there are no listeners to this show, although I'm sure that there are, who are going to hear this and do exactly what I did and be right. like, but bottom. Well,
I was
surprised awful.
That you called it a new drink, because I've been getting that shit off the Chechen black market for fucking years, dude.
It's true. It's like it used to be called Five Loco, yeah, but they had to rebrand.
All right, bottom tier AA speaker.
Ooh, I don't think I know any bad ones, because I don't, I just don't traffic in that, right? Like, I pretty much only listen to AA speakers when somebody that I know, like you or somebody else that I know, says, like, check this out, it's good, mm-hmm. right? But otherwise, you know, I'm not going to find myself really doing that.
Yeah.
Such, you know,
charmed life.
I know, it's great. I don't have any idea. I mean, I've heard about some real weird characters, like that Clancy dude who started the Pacific Group. But even then, I can't say I've ever actually heard the guy talk. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. He might be a great speaker. I don't know.
Okay. He's my grand sponsor, so let's be cool.
Okay. No. So you're Clancy III. There you go.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Bottom tier prayer.
Bottom tier prayer. The other day I was on, as you can tell from this discussion, spent a little too much time on the Reddit AA subreddit, the alcoholism one, and somebody characterized the responsibility statement as a kind of secular prayer that could be used in place of another prayer to close the meeting. And I was like, that is the most awful thing I've ever heard in my life.
That's a new piece of AA lore unlocked for me. I've never heard that. That's so funny.
It was astonishing, and I've seen that people do that. I've seen people close a meeting with the responsibility statement in lieu of a prayer, and so it's kind of being slotted in there to do the work of a prayer. And first of all, it isn't, and second, it's not even good on its own terms, really. I don't know where it comes from, but it's not good.
It's got to be grapevine. It has to be from the grapevine.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think it has to be. It has that vibe.
It has grapevine energy for sure.
It has grapevine energy, yes. So that's my answer on that one. Awful.
All right, bottom tier meeting format.
Bottom tier meeting format is first you start by reading a billion different pieces of pre-meeting warm-up literature, right? You read all 12 steps, all 12 traditions. You read, quote, the promises. And these are all different people, by the way. So there needs to be time for like, hey, you want to unmute and come in? And like, you know, shuffling a paper, like, all right, here we go. So first you do that for 5 or 10 minutes. If there
minimum,
are any people,
come on, minimum,
minimum, right? And then you got to read a lot from the format of the meeting at the beginning. Then you do a day count that counts down like everybody that just says, doesn't even count down. It just says everybody's day count as they're sort of, you know, typing it. This is like a Zoom format. So you type, they're typing into the chat and it's like so-and-so, 539 days. This guy, 2 days. This person, 18 days. As if all this is just like, hey, there's a guy here with 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're just going to brush by that? This guy needs help.
We're just going to applaud right? and move on to day 561 right. guy.
Right, exactly. And then what you do is you engage in, you know, just a little, somebody chooses a topic, right, from a list or a wheel, like a wheel of topics, right? And it's all just sort of single words like, you know, responsibility. And then you just have open sharing on that topic for the 4 to 6 minutes that are open in the meeting to be able to do this. And then you move into various closing ceremonies. Usually there'll be a separate birthdays ceremony at this point that's separate from the day count. All of it has to be met with, you know, various applauding, stuff like that. Yeah. There'll be some jokey invocations of the seventh tradition, right? Like just little shop-worn old-ass humor that's been said a million times, clearly being also read off of the page. Yeah. And it would be better if nobody's laughing, but actually there are like one or two people who are just laughing their ass off. That makes me even more mad that they're laughing at something that I don't think is funny. And then you get to the meeting after the meeting. So that's about as bad as I could do it.
Yeah, this is like this is me processing my trauma with laughter right now.
yeah. I'm sure you could do worse than that, but you'd need creativity. You have to invent something.
Bottom tier big book chapter.
Bottom tier big book chapter. I assume I'm not allowed to use the, I can't just pick like some story I don't like. We're talking about real ones.
Doctor's opinion through Vision for You. It wouldn't to make a choice. It wouldn't be fun.
Right.
Yeah, otherwise.
Well, you can kind of do it by process of elimination, right? The only one, so for example, you kind of can't cut anything from the first, 44 pages or whatever, because that's the description of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. You need all of that. There is a solution is a little bit repetitive of the chapter after it, but I'm not going to call There is a Solution the bottom tier chapter. It's ridiculous. Yeah. You can't get by without the chapter of the agnostic. The next three chapters contain the instructions for the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. So you can hardly leave any of those out. Into Action is a little long. But again, like, it's not that's not bottom tier. Mm-hmm. So then you're left, and then a vision for you is both, I think, quite lovely and sort of essential in the kind of way that it closes. So you're left with the disfavored, you know, stepchildren of the book, and you know, it hurts because I think it actually is a super good chapter. But if you had to cut one, you cut the chapter of the employer, right? Because you know, a lot of it, because a lot of it is anachronistic for one thing, right? It assumes a business environment and an employment environment that just does not correspond to the life of, like, you know, some guy who's working as a, you know, a bartender in Juneau, Alaska. You know, it's just not speaking to his experience. It's speaking to a, you know, it's dated in a way that I think to wives is often accused of being dated, but actually, if one understands the chapter to wives with a gender neutral spirit, actually, I think it is quite contemporary and quite vital. The chapter to the employer, you know,
right.
It's good, but I'm not cutting one. The family afterward, I don't think so.
Okay, last one, bottom tier personal story from the book.
What's the one that says acceptance is the answer?
I think, is that the fucking name of it? I think it's acceptance was the answer. I think that's the name.
Okay, then it's that one. I hate that one. Not because I'm not sure I've ever even read it. So if that bothers you, let me just assure you that acceptance is the answer to your problem with what I just said. But because that slogan, which is so unhelpful, is trotted out in place of the actual instructions for dealing with things like resentment or fear or guilt, right? Like, actually, you know, if I am angry at somebody, acceptance isn't how I would describe the answer to what I needed to do with that, right? Actually, I need to treat my anger as a, you know, something that could kill me. There's something I need to do about it. I need to look at, you know, myself, etc. Like, I got to do all sorts of stuff. And someone just says acceptance is the answer, then I don't know. That's inconsistent with the thing that I actually need to be doing. And so, but because it's pithy, and because by definition it requires, this is the other thing, is it's not an action, right? Like, we recover from this disease, from this illness. I don't want to offend any of the disease versus illness people either. We recover from this seemingly hopeless state by doing a series of things. And acceptance, by definition, is just trying to will yourself into a certain emotional or mental position. Acceptance is like perhaps a good byproduct, right? To borrow the same concept from earlier, that like I certainly feel more at peace with many things that I cannot control than I used to. But that was just a byproduct, like sobriety itself, of deciding to do certain things that are like that require real actions,
right?
Not just a mental position. So whatever that one is, we got to cut it. And the nice thing is, because they do shuffle the stories around in the back, I'm sure that one will be cut for the fifth edition and not, you know, moved right up to the front after Bill's story.
Yeah. I think there's no fucking chance that they will do any changes to the book that will make that not be page 417, because page 417 is like,
that's right,
the meeting maker fucking go to. It's just like, hey, Ernie, do you have a topic? Page 417. It looks up from his Sudoku for 10 seconds to say that, you know?
Yeah, I just made myself mad by realizing that there probably is a person with a page 417 tattoo to combine two ideas here.
Yes.
And, you know, I've got a resentment. Yeah, and I've got a resentment against a person I imagined to make myself mad. You know, just put me on right-wing cable news.
It's as easy as it is. All right. Last question. This one might be difficult for you.
Okay.
I think it'd be difficult for anyone. Describe your experience in AA in one word.
sufficient.
Ooh, okay. All right. Awesome.
I'd elaborate, but I can't. One word. It was sufficient.
Awesome, dude. Well, thank you for doing this, man. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I feel like I really ran my mouth. I guess that's the point of a podcast, but
that's why still, it's one alcoholic talking with another alcoholic, brother.
I love it. I really love it. And, you know, for the people who are listening to this, you know, just so you know, I didn't know any of the things coming in that I was going to have to power rank. So if you've listened to a bunch of these episodes and you feel like you had better answers than me, just know that I learned about this when I was hearing it for the first time. So I just have to, you know, just like ego protect from people, you know, that I've never even met.
People are going to be fucking elbow dropping you in the comments nonstop, dude.
Like, I can't wait for that. I'm so excited. Actually, now I want to go and read the comments for, you know, the last season episode that I was on, see if anybody talked about me. And then either, because then I'll either be mad that they didn't or mad that about whatever they said. So it's just a guaranteed way to make myself upset.
Love it. I could spoil it for you right now, but I won't. That'll be your treat later to do inventory on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's a lovely chat, man. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Love the show. And this was great.
Yeah. Awesome.
This has been a podcast greater than yourself.
A podcast greater than yourself was created by recovered alcoholics. All involved in the creation of this podcast are active members of Alcoholics Anonymous who wish to carry the message of our own recovery to those who still suffer. We do not claim to represent Alcoholics Anonymous. All comments are from our own experiences as alcoholics who have recovered by following the directions for the 12 steps found in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for listening.